And now for something completely different.
This is the Morrow Midday Show on ESPN Radio.
Let's do it.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Morrow Midday Show with Luke Morrow here on ESPN Radio. With it till 3 on this Thursday afternoon with plenty to get to over the next couple of hours. Coming up, game 2 tonight of the NBA Finals. What do the Bucks need to do differently? Plus, Kyle Shanahan spoke at length for, I think, the first time ever about the Falcons losing that Super Bowl a few years back after leading 28-3. And Shanahan talks about his thought process in that fourth quarter. Get to that coming up. We also have a Stanley Cup champion. An interesting top coach ranking for college football, which really says something about one conference in particular. We have our wrestling wrap-up to get to. We got another new sports movie coming out. It's also a throwback Thursday. We'll throw things back a little bit. And a Clemson recruit really impressed over the last couple of days. All that and more over the next couple of hours. You can join the conversation throughout the afternoon, 843-721-9500 to give us a call. You can always text the show, 843-608-1734. You can get to us on Twitter, at Morrow Middays, on Facebook, ESPN Charleston, via email studio@kirkmanbroadcasting.com or online at charlestonsportsradio.com. Head on over to charlestonsportsradio.com, and there you can leave a comment for the show. You can find the latest versions of the show podcasted, or you can take the Morrow Midday Show with you wherever you go by simply streaming us online at charlestonsportsradio.com. With you till 3 on this Thursday, Joe's on the steel wheels. Joe, what's going on? How are you?
Well, we had our little dance with this gal named Elsa and reached Friday Eve, so we're doing quite well, aren't we?
Yes. Hopefully everybody made it through okay. You know, those are always the worst when the storm comes overnight. And that's the worst. And then, you know, God forbid you're asleep, something happens. Maybe you don't want to go to sleep. And I remember telling a story a few weeks ago, maybe a month ago, on the show, and I talked to my mother afterwards, and she said, "Are you an anxious person?" I don't remember what I was talking about at the time. And I'm not overly anxious. There are certain things in life that could give me anxiety or certain things that, you know, I get nervous about. And there are a few of them, not much. I don't have, like, crippling anxiety. I'm a pretty stress-free guy, laid back. But there are certain things that I don't know if I would even say anxious, but just kind of nervous about. I don't know if nervous is even the right word. Just don't like. And one of those things is storms in the middle of the night. And it's not the rain, but it's the fear of tornadoes. I have no problem sleeping through a thunderstorm. But when you tell me there are some tornadoes around, and I believe some tornadoes actually touched down here in the Lowcountry. So hopefully everybody is safe and okay. You made it through the night all right. But if you tell me, hey, a storm's coming from 1 a.m. to about 3 a.m., and there could be some tornadoes rolling through, it's like, yeah, I don't know if I want to go to bed. Now, I stay up late every night regardless, so I just stayed up a little bit later last night. And I said, let me just wait through. I'll stay up and wait this thing out and see if there's anything I got to be concerned of. Fortunately, for me, where I lived, and there were no concerns. And then I went to bed late, and, you know, it was a late night and running on little sleep, but that's okay. Happy to be here talking sports. But about at the start of the pandemic, over a year ago, we had another one of those storms with tornado warnings, tornado watch, and we were on hiatus around here, so I had nothing to get up for the next day. And the storm was supposed to be, same idea, overnight. You probably remember it was like last April, something like that. Anyways, I remember staying up till like 5 or 6 a.m. waiting the thing out. I'm not going to bed if a tornado's coming. And sure enough, you know, the storm finally passed through at like 6 a.m. I had nothing to do the next day anyways. I wasn't working at the time. So I said, all right, now I can go to bed. Didn't have to stay up quite that late last night. But again, I waited the storm out. I said, I'm not going to bed if there's a chance for tornadoes. So that's one of those things that it's not necessarily anxiety. It's more of a comfort thing. Like, yeah, I don't really want to go to bed and have to worry about a tornado rolling through my neighborhood. Because I don't know what it is. My phone, I do not get these alerts. Right, you go out to the store and you hear people's phones going off all the time for like an Amber Alert or a Silver Alert or just weather. My phone, I don't know what it is. I got them turned on. I go into my settings. I look. I'm not like my parents. I'm pretty good with technology. I'm not some senior citizen here trying to figure out their iPhone. I don't know what it is. I don't get the alerts. So, I'm not going to bed. I'm not going to get alerted if something's happening. So, anyways, hope everybody made it through okay last night, all things considered. And ready to go today on a Thursday, a throwback Thursday. Game 2 of the NBA Finals is tonight, Bucks-Suns. Not necessarily a must-win for Milwaukee. You're heading home afterwards. And if you look at the data, teams that are down 2-0 heading home in playoff series win Game 3 like 70% of the time. So you fall down 2-0, you're heading home. History tells you the Bucks will probably get Game 3. They'll be the more desperate team. They'll be at home. They'll have a chance to even up the series. But, digging yourself a 2-0 hole, obviously, is not good. Let me play the role of Captain Obvious, tell you that you don't want to fall down 2-0 in the NBA Finals. Well, what can the Bucks do to avoid that? Make some adjustments. Now, Mike Budenholzer is a guy who has said before, I'm not really a big adjuster. He's upfront about it. He's the type of coach, and I really disagree with this, but he's the type of coach that thinks, hey, we're just going to do our thing. Right? You try to stop us. We don't need to adjust to you. We're a good enough team that we're going to do what we do. You try to stop it. And I never liked that idea. And there are a lot of coaches like that. You see it really more in football especially, where it's like, hey, we're a run-first team. I know they're the number one run defense, but we're going to keep running it. And at halftime, they're averaging a yard and a half per carry, but they're like, oh, this is what we do. We run the football. It's like, yeah, but they're stacking the box on you. Why don't you take some shots downfield? Why don't you open things up a little bit? And the coach will say, no, we're a running team. And I'm not talking about a team that's, a triple option team that can't throw the football. I'm talking in the NFL, say the Titans, the Ravens, these teams that obviously throw the football as well. They just like to run it more, and they continue to pound the football when it's not working, thinking, well, that's what we do. That's how we got here. We're a run first team. Yeah, but sometimes you have to switch it up, right? You don't coach every kid the same way. You don't raise every kid the same way, right? If you're a parent, you handle each of your children differently because they're all different. You don't handle every presentation the same or every sales pitch the same. You adjust your sales pitch to the person you're pitching to. Just like a pitcher on the mound adjusts what they do depending on who they face. Yeah, they may be a power pitcher, right? They may be all about the fastball slider, and that's what they lean on. But then somebody comes up to the plate who can't hit a breaking ball, you're going to throw a few more breaking balls. He's really good against the fastball, can't hit the breaking ball. You're not going to throw him so many fastballs for that one particular batter, even if it's your strength. And there's a lot of coaches that I think it almost comes down to ego, right? Our best against their best, and our best is going to win. They may be just as good defending at what we do really well, but we're even better. We're going to do it better than them. And that doesn't really work out. And so Budenholzer is one of those guys, and he acknowledges it. Yeah, we don't do a lot of adjusting. We are who we are. We're going to go out there, we're going to play our game, and we're going to, win our way. But Milwaukee will have to adjust for Game 2. Because how did Phoenix tear him apart? With the pick and roll. And the pick and roll has become something, growing up playing basketball, it was always the easy play. The inbounds play was always the stack. Every team ran the stack. Every team had some sort of pick and roll because it was so simple. And at a young age, it's hard to defend. And, you have to either get over the screen or you have to be in line defensively to switch properly. A lot of times kids at a young age will get confused. One player will switch, the other won't. Now you're double teaming one player. The other guy's wide open either for a jumper or rolling to the basket. Or you get them to switch and you get the mismatch you want and, you get the bad defender on the kid. And now in the NBA over the last couple of years, it's all about the pick and roll. Every offense is built around the pick and roll. Every team runs what they call horns in the NBA or the college level. Two guys come up to the top of the key, one on each side of the point guard setting a screen, and he picks which side he goes to. And then that signals the play. Watch college basketball. Every team runs the play. They all call it horns. Right? Because the two guys at the top, they're making what looks like horns for the point guard, and you choose which horn you want to go off of as a screen. And it's what the Phoenix Suns do really well, and allowed Chris Paul to have a great game one. In fact, Chris Paul combined between points and assists on more points scored for the Suns than any player in a playoff game other than Michael Jordan and Allen Iverson. That was the third most impactful performance we've seen in the NBA Finals in terms of how many points a player was involved in, either by scoring or assisting, and it was through the pick and roll. And the Bucks couldn't stop it. Brook Lopez only could play half the game. He had to come out at the second half. Right? They don't have the speed to keep up with Ayton or Chris Paul. The Bucks were switching on the screens. Then you get a taller Brook Lopez trying to slow down Chris Paul, who is crafty, can get to the rim, is still quick enough in his age. And credit to Budenholzer, despite what I just said about the lack of adjustments, he did make an adjustment towards the end of game one. We're in that fourth quarter, right? He sat down Brook Lopez, and he sat down Bobby Portis, and he had Giannis playing the five to get some more speed and athleticism at that position instead of the big, you know, kind of goofy Brook Lopez who couldn't keep up. But growing up, as he defend those pick and, you know, the ball screens, pick and rolls, and youth basketball, high school basketball is far different than the NBA. I don't want to try to tell you that, you know, I'm the equivalent to Chris Paul or Mike Budenholzer. Though I did win an NBA Finals once on NBA 2K, right? And I had a franchise, and we won, and we started a dynasty. I won multiple championships. So I feel like I know what I'm talking about. But you were always taught growing up, don't switch on the screens because you're giving them the mismatch they want. And the Bucks continued to switch, and it gave the Suns the mismatch that they wanted, allowing Chris Paul to get to the rim, to get layups, for the Suns to be aggressive, attack the rim, and get to the foul line, where they made a lot more foul shots, attempted a lot more foul shots than Milwaukee. The Suns outscored the Bucks at the free throw line by 16 and beat them by 13. That's a big difference in the game. Mike Budenholzer, the head coach of the Bucks, was talking to the media yesterday in preparation for Game 2 tonight. And Budenholzer was asked about that, about the difference in the foul shooting in Game 1 of the NBA Finals. And here's what the coach of the Milwaukee Bucks had to say.
No, I mean, it's a huge part of the game. You know, they have 25 points from the free throw line. You know, we're a team that prides ourselves in defending and being able to be good defensively without fouling. I can't remember the last time a team got 25 free throws in a game against the Bucks, and then conversely, you know, the way Giannis attacks, the way Chris attacks, as many opportunities as Chris has with the ball. It's frustrating, but it's part of the sport, it's part of the game. We got to be better defensively. We got to keep them off the free throw line, and we got to be more aggressive attacking and getting to the free throw line and getting to good offense.
It was the second time this postseason that a Milwaukee opponent went to the line for 25 free throw attempts. It also happened in the Heat series. Budenholzer said, I can't recall the last time it happened. It did happen one other time in the playoffs, but it is relatively infrequent. Additionally, the Suns' 118 points scored against the Bucks were the second most in this postseason. Milwaukee is one of, maybe, the best defensive teams in the league, and the Suns, while they are good offensively, they were ranked 10th this year in offense. It's not like they are the best offense in the league. And they went off for 118 points the other night, and a large portion was because they shot 96% at the free throw line, getting 25 points from the stripe. But that's what happens when you're aggressive, when you attack the rim, when you get mismatches off the pick and roll, and you can get to the rim and draw fouls, and then you go to the free throw line and you make your foul shots. And the Suns have done that throughout the postseason. As a team, they're shooting something like 87% from the free throw line. Meanwhile, Milwaukee attempted 36 three-pointers, because when you fall behind, you have to try to play catch-up. The Suns were the more aggressive team. They were able to get to the rim, draw fouls, make layups, get to the free throw line. And Chris Paul and DeAndre Ayton, at least in Game 1, were a tough mismatch, a tough matchup for the Milwaukee Bucks. This was Stephen A. Smith after Game 1. He joined Scott Van Pelt on SportsCenter two nights ago. And Stephen A. talked about how Milwaukee was unprepared for what the Suns threw at them in Game 1.
Well, it was a sensational performance. You've got a veteran leader that's had 16 years in the league, and even with devoid of a championship, is still recognized as one of the greatest point guards to have ever played this game. But yep. When you couple that with the inabilities of the Milwaukee Bucks, you look at CP3 and you say, well, duh, what did you expect from him? When you're going to put Bobby Portis on him, when you got Brook Lopez on him, when you got P.J. Tucker on him. Wilbon and I were just talking about that a few minutes ago. What the hell do you expect is going to happen? It is mind-boggling to me how I don't want to be insulting, but absolutely clueless the Milwaukee Bucks appeared last night in being prepared for this game. Uh-huh. You know that CP3 and Devin Booker, you know what they're going to give to you, particularly when they're hitting their perimeter shots. But a guy like CP3 is literally picking defenders. Who am I going to pick on next?
Right.
And absolutely, positively, no adjustment was made whatsoever. And that's why he looked so spectacular.
That was Stephen A. after Game 1 of the NBA Finals. Game 2 tonight will come down to the adjustments. Right, that's why Game 1's the feeling out process. Milwaukee saw what the Suns like to do. The Suns saw how Milwaukee likes to defend it. Now tonight, who's going to switch things up? Phoenix really doesn't have a reason to switch things up. It worked so well in Game 1. So can Milwaukee be the team to make adjustments? A lot of times, Budenholzer is not that type of guy. We'll see if the Bucks continue to switch tonight, 1 through 5, on ball screens. I would say no. Right? Guards have become so athletic, so tough. Point guards used to be about distributing. And maybe they weren't always the best shooter. So when it came to a ball screen, you could go under the screen. Right? Ah, give him the shot. And let's defend the guy rolling to the hoop. He's a good distributor. The point guard's looking to pass it. Nowadays, point guards are as much a scorer as anyone else. And they're so athletic, you don't want your big guy, a Brook Lopez, on a guard. Because you're talking about Chris Paul, Devin Booker, Trey Young, Luka Doncic. That's what they want. They want your, you know, awkward center to come out and try to guard Trey Young on the perimeter. He'll blow past you. He'll get to the rim. Or Luka Doncic. Right? That's what they want. Those are the type of matchups they're looking for. And in the third quarter alone, off those ball screens, right, the Suns, I think it was Devin Booker alone, went something like 6 for 7 in the third quarter. Because he's got Bobby Portis on him, and he's got Brook Lopez, and they can't catch up. They can't keep up. The other factor will also be the health of Giannis. How much healthier will he be tonight? He looked good enough in game one, all things considered, when you consider that the injury had just occurred a few days earlier, but did not look good enough to try to carry the Bucks to a victory. How much healthier will he be tonight? How much stronger will he be? Because the other adjustment you can make is what the Bucks tried in the fourth quarter, is have Giannis be that number five. Have Giannis be the center. He's athletic enough to try to keep up with a Chris Paul instead of Brook Lopez. Tonight's game two in Phoenix will probably come down to the adjustments. The Suns wore down the Bucks with the pick and roll. Now let's see what Milwaukee can do about it. Coming up, Kyle Shanahan went on a podcast this week with Sean McVay and Peter Schrager. And it's being billed as the first time he's actually talked about the play calling in the fourth quarter of that Super Bowl where the Falcons blew a 28-3 lead. We'll listen to the audio and break it down next. Sorry to open up the wound, Falcons fans, but Shanahan breaking down his play calling at the end of that Super Bowl. We'll touch on it when we come back. It's the Moore Midday Show right here on ESPN Radio.
It's Throwback Thursday.
What's today?
It's Thursday.
Really? Feels like Tuesday.
Tuesday has no feel. Monday has a feel. Friday has a feel. Sunday has a feel.
I feel Tuesday and Wednesday.
All right, shut up, the both of you.
On the Morrow Midday Show.
Shanahan breaks down his play calling at the end of the Falcons Super Bowl a few years ago that saw Atlanta cough up a 25-point lead. And we'll get to that in just a moment here on the Moore Midday Show with Luke Morrow on ESPN Radio. Hope everybody made it through the night okay with the tropical storm rolling through overnight. Rained pretty good where I lived. Got some good lightning, some big thunder. I know there's plenty of tornado warnings in the area overnight, so hopefully everyone's okay. I think a few tornadoes even touched down. Could have been worse, of course. Right? At least it wasn't a hurricane, and it was the max winds or sustained winds was only about 40 miles an hour, so could have been a lot worse, but hopefully everybody made it through okay. Open the show talking about the NBA Finals tonight, Game 2. And for a lot of people in Milwaukee or Wisconsin, the big concern tonight is how are we going to slow down these Suns? Or maybe they're worried about the health of Giannis. But for a large portion of the state of Wisconsin tonight, heading into Game 2 of the NBA Finals, what they're most concerned about is the official cheese of the state. Apparently, the politicians in Wisconsin are trying to pass a bill that would recognize Colby cheese as the official state cheese. And this is a bill that has failed multiple times. That's why one of the politicians referenced Winston Churchill about never giving up. They're really, I don't know what it is. It's named after a town in the state, Colby Cheese, from where it was first developed or produced. And so they want to make Colby Cheese the official cheese of Wisconsin. And this has become a big battle in Wisconsin. Joe, what is your favorite type of cheese? If you, you're making a sandwich, what type of cheese you like to put?
Usually either cheddar, American, or pepper jack.
Ooh, pepper jack. That's good stuff. Now, I always go with provolone on a sandwich. I love provolone. Always do the provolone on a sandwich. I got a sandwich today for lunch. go with the provolone. But the number one most used or sold cheese out of the state of Wisconsin is the mozzarella. Right? Ah, that's the good stuff. They must be eating a lot of pizza up there, because that's where you use all that. That's where you use the mozz, where you get some mozz sticks. But Wisconsin, I'll tell you what, Wisconsin has it right. Because the three things that they're most known for, the three things they do the most producing of in the food and beverage industry, cheese, beer, and brats, right, like sausage. Now, that's a good lifestyle. Shockingly, as a state, they're only the 17th most obese state in the country, Wisconsin. I actually would have thought they were higher. South Carolina, by the way, is number 10, the 10th most obese state in the country. And in case you were curious, this data does not include New Jersey for whatever reason. So it's only of the 49 states. But Colorado, I found that surprising. Colorado is the least obese state in the country. And I figured with all the munchies they get, Colorado would be quite the eaters. They'd be pretty high on the list. Hawaii is right ahead of them. I can understand that. You're outside, out at the beach. Got to keep the beach bod. You're out doing activities. Maybe you're doing some hiking. Mississippi, by the way, the most obese state. But many in Wisconsin right now forget about the NBA Finals. They're concerned about what their official cheese is going to be. Will it become the Colby cheese? Will it be a pepper jack? Right? Will it be the mozzarella? Will it be something? Will it be the provolone? Hoping to pass that bill in Wisconsin to establish Colby as the state's official cheese. Colby would not be very high on my official cheese rankings. Maybe we'll have to do that someday. Get some smoked Gouda in there. That's pretty good stuff. So Kyle Shanahan was on a podcast this week with Sean McVay and Pete Schrager. Pete Schrager covers the NFL. Sean McVay is obviously the coach of the Rams. And they host a podcast. And they have other coaches come on, frequently Kyle Shanahan. And it's a really good podcast because McVay is very frank and open. And so are the guests, like Shanahan, because he's very good friends with McVay. And it's just like buddies talking and they're very honest in these conversations. And Shanahan was talking about the fourth quarter of the Super Bowl between the Falcons and the Patriots, in which the Falcons in that second half coughed up a 25-point lead. It's a bit of a long clip, but here's Shanahan explaining his thought process at the end of that game. We all know the drive. Sorry to open this wound, Falcons fans. But this is believed to be the first time that Shanahan's actually talked about it in some detail. And here's what Shanahan had to say about his thought process all those years ago in the fourth quarter as he was the offensive coordinator for the team that committed the biggest choke in Super Bowl history.
Everyone talks about us, not us, talks about me throwing it too much in the Super Bowl with the Falcons. But we ran it more in the first, we ran it more in the second half than we did in the first half. It was about not having the ball. But I will say, I sat there so long and watched Tom Brady just pick us apart and go 34, 36, or whatever he did. And I remember saying, if we get this ball back, I'm not waiting. We got to go. And we hit this big, Julio caught that huge play.
Oh, my God, on the sidelines.
Where it was just like, oh, my God, Julio is unstoppable. And we ran the ball, and it got to second and 10. The last time I was down there, it was second and 10. I ran the ball, and they stuffed us and got us to third and 11. Yet we also had a holding call on it. And it knocked us back out of field goal range. So we threw it to Julio. He caught that. I ran it the next play, got to second and 10. And I was like, I'm going right to Julio. And I called a play to totally go to Julio. Right when we snapped it, the coverage took it away. So it was the wrong call. And I wish we didn't take a sack, but no one was open and we ended up taking a sack. And right then I was like, oh my God, why did I just try to end it? Mm-hmm. Like, and that got at me because it was like, I knew because it was a buildup for an hour of watching Tom. I'm like, man, I just tried to end it. I think I was thinking right, because who the hell is not going to Julio Jones right now? And oh my God, now we're not. And I got to throw the ball to get back to field goal range. And so the next play, I threw the ball. It was a 5-yard out to Mohamed Sanu. Caught it, turned up the field for a 12-yard gain. Back in field goal range, but they called a holding on our left tackle on Jake Matthews on Chris Long, which wasn't even close to the holding that happened on every third down in the Super Bowl. Was that 2 weeks later? But it got called that day, so I had to deal with it. And then you got to live with it the rest of your life. And it's just those are the things, and you don't get a chance. Like it's not like
no, hey, Kyle, you can't always answer and be like.
But it comes down to one play, and that's what I've always said. Like, yeah, I wish I called a different call on that one play.
And Sean,
for the final everything, you get into you're down, you get into 2 minutes, you throw the ball six plays straight, but like. that one right there.
Yeah, but see, here's,
I think it would have been different.
Shanahan talking about that fourth quarter of the Super Bowl 4 years ago between the Falcons and Patriots. And we all remember the sequence. The Falcons get down into field goal range, look like they have the game sealed. Julio Jones makes that incredible catch that, unfortunately, because of the outcome of the game, will not be remembered as it should. And as Shanahan breaks down there, decides to throw the football, trying to end the game, going for the jugular. And there was a sack, there was a holding call out of field goal range, ball goes back to New England, they send the game to overtime, they win it in overtime, Falcons fans have their hearts ripped out of them. And you're probably thinking back to that moment again, you're driving around today, right, slamming on the steering wheel, thinking back to that moment just over about four and a half years ago when the Falcons coughed up a 25-point lead in the second half to New England. First time that Shanahan spoke at length about that decision and the honesty from Kyle Shanahan, where he admits in that call, or in that clip, that after, as soon as the play unfolded and they took the sack, that he regretted that decision. Think like, oh, what was I doing? Oftentimes, and I say this a lot on the show, we focus on the results instead of the process. You could have a great process and things just don't go your way and you don't get the results you want. You could study all week long. You go to class every day, all day of the semester. You can always do your work. You could pay attention. You could take great notes. You can study. At the end, you could still get an F on the final exam. You worked as hard as you could. You put in the effort. The stuff just didn't sit. The material just didn't work for you. It just didn't sit with you. Your process was good. The end result was not. And you could understand that a little bit better than the kid who skips class all semester and then bombs the final exam. You'd be more disappointed in that because you think, well, what were you doing? You never went to class. You didn't give yourself a chance. And then vice versa, there are some kids that, you know, don't work very hard, skip class every once in a while, they don't do the homework, but they're good test takers or they know the material well enough that they still pass the final exam. Wasn't the best process, but it got you the result that you wanted. You wouldn't recommend that moving forward. Like, yeah, you probably should go to class. You probably should study every once in a while, even though you passed. And so we focus oftentimes on the results instead of the process. But in this case, I think it's both. I think both are the same. The results were bad. I thought the process was bad as well. And it's easy to say that hindsight, you know, being 2020, armchair quarterback here years after the Super Bowl, or even the next day after the Super Bowl. But watching that game, as it was unfolding, you were thinking, what are they doing? Run the football, kick the field goal. And I didn't think the juice was worth the squeeze. And Shanahan says in that clip, he realized right away, after things didn't work out, right, that it seemed to be a mistake. But that's the effect of the Patriots. Right, people will always say, oh, the Patriots are so lucky. They catch so many breaks. But that's why they catch breaks. Alabama's the same way. Right, it's the Belichick effect. The Belichick effect is twofold. Number one, it leads to teams making a lot of changes. The teams around the Patriots. The other teams in the division that fire their coaches every 2 years. It really ramps up the pressure of their competitors, their rivals. Alabama's the same way with Saban. The amount of coaches we've had shuffle in and out of the SEC. Because Saban and Alabama have been so dominant and so impressive, and you want to catch up to them, they raise the bar for everybody. Alabama has set the standard. That's what the other teams, contending teams in the SEC, now have to reach. And when they have a coach that can't reach that, because really nobody can, Saban's the best to do it, they move on from that coach hoping to find somebody else that can do it. Same idea in the AFC East going up against Belichick. That's why the Jets, the Dolphins, the Bills have shuffled through coaches over the years. Right? They have very little patience. A couple of years, nope. You're not a Bill Belichick. We got to go find, hopefully, the next Bill Belichick. Try to keep up with this team. But the second part of the equation is also what happens in games. And it's why many people watch the Patriots over the years and think, oh, they are so lucky. It's why Rob Parker of Fox Sports refers to Tom Brady as the luckiest of all time instead of the GOAT. And you go back and you look, and yeah, the Patriots have a lot of breaks. But why do they get those breaks? Because moments like this. Shanahan said, I was on the sidelines watching all second half as Tom Brady went up and down the field. And when we went out there, I felt like we had to do something to try to put the game away instead of maybe remaining disciplined. Right? You make an out-of-character decision because of who you're going up against. And you realize, like, hey, if we don't go for the jugular here, right, Tom Brady's on the other side. He's going to get the football back. We're in trouble. It's why Kirby Smart goes for a fake punt when he's got Alabama on the ropes. Right? Goes for a fake punt at midfield and led to their downfall. That was in the SEC title game. They end up losing the game. And that was the end. That swung the game. And when it happened, as it unfolded, everyone watching the game is thinking, what are you doing? What a terrible play call. If you're going to go for it, just go for it. Or punt it away. A fake punt didn't work. Alabama wins the game. And you're thinking, well, that was a terrible call. What are you thinking, Kirby? What he was thinking was, I'm going up against Alabama. Right? Coaches will panic. Players will panic. You'll make out-of-character decisions or plays. You'll be ultra-aggressive, thinking you have to because you're going up against, you know, the best of all time in Brady, Belichick, or Nick Saban. And that's what may have happened there at Kyle Shanahan, that he's on the sidelines the whole time, seeing the lead continue to shrink and shrink, and Brady's going on and on and on, throwing it all over the field. And there's a little bit of, hey, we can do that too, and also a little bit of, hey, let's try to keep him from continuing to do that. But it's the toughest part of being an offensive coordinator, is staying patient or staying disciplined. You know, I talked earlier about Mike Budenholzer not making adjustments, and I compared it to the football coach who will continually ram his head into the wall. We're just going to keep running it and running it and running it. And it's like, you know, the run game's not working today. There's stuff in the box. Your offensive line is getting mauled. How about you try throwing it? But a lot of offensive coordinators will bail on something too soon. The run game isn't going through the first two possessions. They'll say, all right, we got to throw the football. That's the toughest part of being an offensive coordinator, staying patient, remaining persistent, remaining disciplined, and keep doing what you do or what you should do. And in that case, for the Falcons, it was running the football. And in that moment, in that fourth quarter, you run the football, you kick the field goal, but Shanahan wasn't disciplined enough. He was watching Brady on the other side. He was feeling the heat of going up against New England and with the lead continuing to shrink, and they had to do something maybe a little out of character. That normally in those situations, you're running the football, you're playing it safer, you're kicking the field goal, you get out of there Super Bowl champs. But he thought, this is the Patriots. Things are not going our way the second half. Brady's been moving up and down the field. We got Julio Jones over here. Right, you get a little bit out in front of your skis. You get a little too excited. And you make a decision that really blows up in your face. Now, that Julio Jones catch referenced in that clip, I said this at the time of the trade when he went to Tennessee a few months ago, but if the Falcons win that game, that catch goes down to all the others as one of the greatest catches in Super Bowl history. Not only because of how important of a catch it would have been if it led to the game-sealing field goal, but also because of the catch that it was, the play that he had to make that catch. And because the Falcons lost, we focus instead on the blown lead and forget about that great catch down the sideline in the fourth quarter. But if the Falcons hold on to win that game, that's right up there. I would put it right up there with David Tyree, because David Tyree's catch was more luck than Jones. Right? Jones was more about skill than David Tyree. And how often do we talk about that Tyree catch? Eli Manning spins his way out of a sack, just hoists it downfield. Tyree makes the catch against his helmet. Julio Jones, that was a more skillful play. That was a craftier catch along the sidelines. And it would have been a huge catch had the Falcons held on. Instead, it's a catch that we forget, and it really changes the legacy of a Julio Jones or a Matt Ryan if the Falcons win that game. But I thought interesting comments and transparency from Kyle Shanahan, really for the first time talking about it, admitting that he regretted the call, right? Talking about it all these years later. I'm sure he still thinks about it, especially for the fact that a couple of years later, now with the 49ers as a head coach, he also coughed up a double-digit lead in the fourth quarter of a Super Bowl once again, 2 years ago against the Chiefs. And that's the legacy that will, for the time being, hang with Kyle Shanahan. But why do the Patriots always seem to get the breaks? Why does Alabama always seem to get the breaks? Because that's what they force you to do. Make out-of-character decisions, feel the pressure. Right? John Casey with the kickoff out of bounds against New England in that Panthers Super Bowl many years ago. Out of character, never does it before. Right, and you think, oh, the Patriots are so lucky. Yeah, there may be something to that, but also part of it is that other team, right, they're the ones with the sweaty palms. And they're the ones, they haven't been there before. They're going up against the greatest of all time. And they know what the Patriots can do at the end of games with all their great wins with Vinatieri and the comebacks that they've pulled off. And you start feeling the pressure. They're not feeling it. You start feeling it. And when you're making pressured decisions, right, a lot of times we're making the wrong decisions. That's why I said the Falcons should draft a quarterback. When you're making desperate decisions, that's when you always make mistakes. And you could get a little desperate against a team like New England or a team like Alabama in the fourth quarter of a huge game. But I thought it was interesting to hear Shanahan's thoughts on that sequence from 4.5 years ago. Falcons fans, sorry to ruin your Thursday. It's something that until Atlanta wins the Super Bowl, you'll probably never escape from. Coming up, speaking of winning a championship, we crowned the champion in the NHL last night. We don't talk a lot of hockey around here. But this is very interesting because, oh, Canada, the drought continues. We'll get to that when we come back. It's the Morrow Midday Show right here on ESPN Radio.
You're listening to the Morrow Midday Show on ESPN Radio.
a Stanley Cup champion. And the drought continues for Canada. It's the Mara Midday Show with Luke Morrow here on ESPN Radio. A little bit later on, we also have another new sports movie coming out that they just announced yesterday. And I watched the trailer last night, and I got to be honest, it looks pretty awful. We'll get to that coming up later on, the story about a Hall of Fame athlete. But we crowned a champion last night in the NHL. Congratulations to the Tampa Bay Lightning. Back-to-back Stanley Cups for the Tampa Bay Lightning. And what's most impressive is that they're doing this during during the pandemic, the 2 years that have been affected by the pandemic. And the Lightning win the Stanley Cup in these two seasons. Now, I'm not a big hockey guy. I'm an average hockey fan. But hockey people have told me that the team's probably going to break up now. I guess they have a lot of expiring contracts or, you know, they're just in a situation now where the team, the roster, is going to split. So they get their back-to-back Stanley Cups. We'll see how they do next year. But this damn Tampa Bay, ever since Tom Brady got there, right? Apparently, it's the Tom Brady curse for all the other cities. He shows up in Boston, and the Red Sox finally start winning some World Series, and the Patriots win their first Super Bowls, and the Bruins, right? And the Celtics get their big three and win an NBA Finals. Now Brady goes to Tampa, and since then, the Lightning are back-to-back Stanley Cup champs. The Tampa Bay Rays were in the World Series. The Buccaneers obviously won the Super Bowl. They're the favorite to do it again this year. Not enough already. I'm already tired of the Tampa Bay area, all their championships. Now, I benefited a little bit from Brady's run in Boston because being a Red Sox fan, right, life has been pretty good as a Red Sox fan the last 20 years. So I thank Brady for that. But the rest of it, I don't care about the – I don't want to see Patriots Super Bowls, the Bruins, the Celtics even. Now we got to deal with Tampa winning all these championships. All right, the Buccaneers will probably go back-to-back just like the Lightning. It's crazy. But the biggest story to come out of this, as I always say, the more interesting story is always in the losing locker room. How about the fact that Canada continues their drought? It has now been 28 years since a Canadian team won the Stanley Cup. And for all intents and purposes, hockey is Canada's sport. I mean, we know how rabid they are as fans of that sport in Canada. And while the sport was originally hockey, the genesis, the origin story dates back to England, but modern hockey was created by a Canadian in Montreal. You know, so that's their sport. It'd be like our Olympic basketball team, right? If in the Olympics, our basketball team never won gold. But there was a reason why we had the dream team. There's a reason why our team in the Olympics, you know, even without the best players in our country, blow out these other countries by 50 points. We should. We have the most talent here. It's our sport. Right? And if we were going to the Olympics and never winning the gold or never placing, right, not doing very well, I'd be like, what is going on here? This is embarrassing. And it's a similar sense for Canada. The majority of NHL players do come from Canada. So it's not just that they created the sport and, you know, the fans are into it. I mean, the majority of the players, they grow up, more talent comes from Canada for that sport than any other. Now, that doesn't mean that they're going to play for the Canadian teams. But, again, right, they're crazy about the sport. They should have the best decision makers, be able to get some of the best talent, have plenty of money to spend because they have great fan bases. And to go 28 years. And it's not like they just have one or two teams. We're not talking about the NBA with only the Toronto Raptors. 7 of the 30 teams in the NHL are based in Canada. So almost a quarter of the league is based in Canada, and yet it's been 28 years since they won a Stanley Cup. In fact, the last time a Canadian team won the Stanley Cup was the 1992 season. It was the Montreal Canadiens. That was the first year of the Tampa Bay Lightning. The Tampa Bay Lightning, their first year of existence, was the last time Canada won a Stanley Cup. Since then, all the Lightning have done is, well, become a franchise and then win 3 Stanley Cups. And all the Canadian teams have been shut out. And in that stretch, in these 28 years, we've had 6 different teams win multiple Stanley Cups. And we've had 13 different teams win at least one Stanley Cup. They, of course, are all based here in the States. But the Canadian teams have not won a Stanley Cup in 28 years. 5 Canadian teams have made it to a Stanley Cup during that stretch. They have all lost. 4 of them losing in a Game 7. Right? Brutal. You have the Toronto Maple Leafs that have the longest Stanley Cup drought in the NHL. It's now up to 53 seasons. The last time they won the Stanley Cup was 1966, before the expansion era. Right, back when the league was a little bit different. There were fewer teams, more of them. Right, there was a larger percentage of teams in Canada. And the Maple Leafs haven't won in 53 years. After that, you also have, what's the other team? They haven't won in their entire existence. Another team in Canada. I had it just in front of me. I have to find that. They've been around for 50 years. I've never won a Stanley Cup. Right, these Stanley Cup droughts have been the worst for these Canadian-based teams. And I find this very interesting. I know Canadian hockey fans are very upset with the lack of success that their teams have had. As you can imagine, we'd be very upset if our basketball didn't stack up to other countries, or maybe even our baseball. Right? There are certain sports that you expect to be your strong suit. And also, by the way, I don't know, maybe there's something to this, because while the majority of players in the NHL come from Canada, it's actually at an all-time low. Now, again, these are two separate conversations, because it's not like the Canadian players only play for the Canadian teams. But a little bit of maybe a bad stretch for hockey in Canada, because they've gone 28 years now without winning a Stanley Cup. And currently, 43% of the league is Canadian, which is the lowest percentage in NHL history. 35 years ago, it was about 80% of the league. So the game is growing in other countries, including this one. And while that doesn't have a direct correlation to the Canadian teams failing to win a Stanley Cup, we still have this drought of 28 years in the NHL without a team based in Canada winning a Stanley Cup. It's been a tough time for the hockey fans north of the border.
I would say the majority of the players now are from Central and Eastern Europe.
Yeah, there's a larger portion of them of that. The percentage of Americans has increased. But still, 43% of the league made up of Canadian players. About a quarter of the league made up of Canadian teams. 28 years without a Stanley Cup. And this year, because of the pandemic, didn't they separate the teams that essentially one of the two conferences was made up? They kept all the Canadian teams together. So, like, you have, like, a guarantee. Not a guarantee, but you have a really good shot that one of the Canadian teams will make it to the Stanley Cup this year. They did, and they lost to the Tampa Bay Lightning in, five games? So 28 years. Tough drought.
And I have not been able to find the clip of Jim Brewer and his buddies coming into a sports bar and interrupting Jeff Goldblum's band, you know, going, yeah, Lightning, which, from what I hear, Jim Brewer is a real-life Tampa Bay Lightning fan.
How about that?
During one of the goth talk skits from the 90s from Saturday Night Live.
Interesting. Yeah, I found it. It's the Vancouver Canucks. The Maple Leafs haven't won since 67, the 66-67 season, 53 years. The Canucks have never won in their 50 seasons. That's the second longest drought. And it's tied with Buffalo, I mean, they might as well be Canada. 28 years without a Stanley Cup for a team based in Canada in the NHL. The drought continues. And congratulations to the Tampa Bay Lightning, not only getting back-to-back Stanley Cups, but doing it during a pandemic with the two maybe most unusual seasons we've had in hockey. We'll wrap up Hour 1 when we come back. It's the Morrow Midday Show right here on ESPN Radio.
Now back to the Morrow Midday Show on ESPN Radio.
Wrapping up Hour 1 here in the Morrow Midday Show with Luke Morrow on ESPN Radio. Great song. This was used in the Mark Wahlberg movie, Four Brothers, which I always enjoyed. It takes place in Detroit. Came out about 15 years ago. And spoiler alert, the movie's 15 years old. This song was used when it was revealed Josh Charles was a crooked cop. The actor Josh Charles. That was the character there. And he was the bad guy in the movie. It's a good film. I actually, speaking of Hollywood, revolving detectives and cops, or involving, revolving around, I just finished Mayor of Easttown on HBO yesterday with Kate Winslet. Oh, great show. Miniseries, only 7 episodes. Finished it last night on HBO. excellent. Loved it. I wish there were more episodes. Great show. Hey, we got the schedule for the SEC Media Days, which tells you football is right around the corner. And Media Days, they begin in a week and a half. Not next week, but the following week. And it starts on Monday, July 19th, and it begins with the Gamecocks' new head coach, Shane Beamer. He'll be on that first day with some good company. Dan Mullen of Florida, Ed Orgeron of LSU. And then on Tuesday, you get Kirby Smart, Mark Stoops, Lane Kiffin, Josh Heupel. On Wednesday, you get Nick Saban, Mike Leach, Jimbo Fisher, Clark Lee. And on Thursday, July 22nd, you get Sam Pittman, Brian Harsin, and Eli Drinkwitz. So there you go. The Media Day schedule is out. I know that's a big deal around these parts. For me, it's the biggest deal is that it just signals football's around the corner. All right, so in 11 days, we'll be starting the Media Days. And then just over a month, about 5 weeks after that, we'll be talking about actual games starting up. The actual Media Days themselves, I've never really been into the press conferences, right? Not you don't get much from it. It'll be interesting to hear what Shane Beamer has to say going into his first year. And we'll have some audio, I'm sure, during that week. But it's not the big thrill of the week isn't like, oh, we get to hear all these coaches talk about the upcoming season. Yeah, big whoop. The real thrill is that it signals football's right around the corner. As we are now about 7 weeks away, I think it is, maybe 8 weeks still. From today on Thursday, the season will start on a Thursday a few weeks from now, and I'll be here before you know it. Looking forward to college football coming back in just a few weeks. Speaking of which, coming up next hour, does Clemson already have their next quarterback star who's not even on campus yet? And one conference needs to do more in college football. We'll get to that coming up. It's the Mar Midday Show here on ESPN Radio.